Chapter 17. Raymond's ship docked in New York on a Wednesday in late August, 1959. He reported for work at the Daily Press early Thursday morning. Marco called him and made a date to meet him at 4 o'clock in Hungarian Charlie's, the saloon across the street from the paper, saying he would be bringing two of his sidekicks with him if Raymond wouldn't mind. Raymond didn't mind. The four men sat at a table far in the rear of the saloon, which was a solid, practical saloon, set up to sell a maximum amount of booze, and with careful attention to unsanitary-seeming decor, a little dirt here, a little grease there, a minimum amount of food, which after all has a tendency to spoil after a week or so and can be a loss. The air was nearly gelid from the huge air-conditioning unit that looked big enough to chill an automobile assembly plant. A giant jukebox, manufactured by the Giant Jukebox Company of Arcana, Illinois, was belting everything living right over the head with a loudly lovable old standard out of Memphis, Tennessee, in which the rhyme of the proper name Betty Lou and the plural noun shoes were repeated in a Kallikakian couplet over and over again. A giant jukebox is constructed to make a sound like two full-sized, decibel-pregnant jukeboxes going at top volume at the same time. But two separate jukeboxes, each playing a different tune, each in a different tempo, and if possible, in a different language. The joint was noisy from opening to closing, because Hungarian Charlie liked noise, and was, in every vocal manner, very much like a giant jukebox himself. After minimum handshaking and ordering a highball for Amjack and Laner and beers for Raymond and himself, Marco went right to business by asking Raymond to tell his version of the battle action, which Raymond did forthwith and in detail, utilizing only the future tense in verb forms. Laner carried the tape recorder in a shoulder sling. "You sound as though you got those nightmares straightened out. In fact, you look it," Raymond said warily, not sure whether it was proper to talk about such things in front of these house detective types. Marco looked great. He had gained the weight back. "All over. Did you... was it... did that thing we were talking about help any? The court-martial?" "Yeah." "The way it worked out, it wasn't necessary. But I still have you and only you to thank for losing those nightmares. We got a different kind of an investigation started, just the way you said it had to be, and the nightmares were gone. Forever, I hope." "Did you investigate the metal?"
"Sure."
"What else?"
"Any progress?" "Slow, but good."
"Is it working out the way we thought?"
"Yeah, right down the line."
"The metal is a phony?"
"It certainly looks that way."
"I knew it.
I knew it!"
Raymond looked from Amjack to Laner, shaking his head in awed disbelief.
"How about that?" he asked with mystification. "Will you tell me why a lot of communist brass would want to steal a Medal of Honor for a complete stranger?"
Amjack didn't answer. He seemed embarrassed about something. Raymond became aware of his silence and stared at him coldly.
"It was a rhetorical question," he said haughtily.
Amjack coughed. He said,
"It scares hell out of us if you want the truth, Mr. Shaw. We have run out of ideas, and we don't know where else to look, if that gives you some idea."
Raymond swung his gaze to Laner, who had a head like a gourd, a small mustache, and eyes like watermelon seeds. And Laner stared him down.
"Have you talked to Al Melvin?" Raymond said.
The voice of a sick child whined out of the giant jukebox behind them as though trying to escape the hateful noises behind it.
"You know Ben, Al, in Alaska."
"Yes, sir, we have,"
Amjack said grimly.
Marco said, "Raymond, there is no known area of this case which we haven't covered in many ways. We've talked to every member of the patrol. We've traveled maybe 9,200 miles around the country. We're sure Chun Jin is here as an enemy agent, assigned to you as a bodyguard and assassin if necessary. I have a unit in New York and Washington which does nothing but concentrate on this problem. There are 17 of us all told. Mr. Amjack is on loan from the FBI, and Mr. Laner is with us as an expert from Central Intelligence. Working on that riddle of why the enemy should go to enormous trouble to secure the Medal of Honor for you is all I do, day and night. It's all Amjack and Laner do. It's all the 17 of us do. And the White House wants to know what happened in a report every week, and a copy of that report goes to the Joint Chiefs."
"And you want to hear something offbeat, Raymond?
I mean something that will throw this out of context for a moment to let you see what a unique person you have become. A copy of the report goes to the Prime Ministers of Britain and Canada and to the President of Mexico.
But what the hell for?
Raymond seemed outraged at this invasion, as though he were being shared by four heads of government.
What the hell do the Mexicans and the bloody British who tried to kill my mother, incidentally, have to do with that lousy medal?
Lehner tapped Raymond on the forearm. Raymond looked at him, drawing his arm away.
Why don't you listen? Lehner said. If you talk, you can't learn anything.
Don't touch me again, Raymond said.
If you want to remain here with us, doing your clerk's tasks and waiting for your pension, do not touch me again. He looked at Marco.
Continue, Ben, he said equably.
It is our considered opinion, Marco said, that we are moving into the area of action, which will reveal why they wanted you to have the Medal of Honor. The patrol happened in 1951. Chun-Jin didn't arrive to take up his duties until 59, 8 years lapse. Whatever is going to happen soon. You're a marked man, Raymond. They've marked you, and they guard you. We've marked you. Am I frightening you, Raymond?
Me?
Nothing frightened, Raymond. A man needs to have something to lose to become frightened. Even only one thing that is his and that he values will make it possible for threat to scare a man. But Raymond had nothing.
That's what I explained to our unit. And that's what our psychiatrists had projected on you, that attitude, that fearlessness, you know? But I have to frighten you, Raymond, because we need you to think of yourself as some kind of time bomb with a fuse 8 years long. You walk barefooted on the edge of a razor. Only you will know when the change comes, when the mission is divulged, when your move is to be made, and it can only end one way. Your country, my country, this country, will have to be in danger from you, and you will be expected to do exactly as you have been told or will be told.
They got inside your mind.
They did. I swear before God.
Raymond disliked this kind of talk. It sickened him. What kind of a world of fondlers had this become? Why did Marco have to say that those thick-necked pigs were inside his mind?
I told you that we talked to every member of the patrol this summer. You know what they said about you, every one of them? That you were the greatest, warmest, most wonderful single guy they had ever met. They remembered you with love and affection, Raymond. Isn't that funny?
Funny? It's ludicrous.
How do you account for it?
Raymond shrugged and grimaced.
I saved their lives. I mean, they thought I had saved their lives. I suppose the poor slobs were grateful.
I don't think so. I've had to work all this out with our psychiatrists because I don't have a very objective view either. But my actual memory is that there was a broad chasm between you and those men before the patrol. They didn't hate you. They seemed rather to fear your scorn, you know. You had a way of freezing their dislike and keeping them uneasy and off balance. The psychiatrists will tell you that an attitude, a group attitude as well as individual attitudes like that, can be changed into warm and eager interest, into such admiration and deep respect, merely because of gratitude. No, no, no.
Life isn't a popularity contest, Raymond said. I didn't ask them to like me.
I'm going to start to prove right now that they have gotten inside your mind, Raymond, because you once told me in a joking way that you had come out of the army with much more of an active interest in women than when you went in. And because I have to frighten you, I will have to embarrass you too. We checked. We are experts. Experts, even. We went back over the seams of your life looking for lint. You were 22 going on 23 years old when you left the army, and you had never been laid. More than that, you had never even kissed a girl. Had you, Raymond?
Marco leaned across the table, his eyes lambent with affection, and he said softly,
You never even kissed Josie, did you, Raymond?
You had men talk to Josie? In Argentina?
Raymond wasn't outraged. Long before, he had set all his dials so that Marco could do no wrong with him. But he was extremely impressed, and for the first time. He felt elated to be in connection with anyone who had looked at Josie, had sat beside her, and had spoken to her about anything at all. And to have spoken to her about him. About that wondrous summer together. And about kissing.